Before we get started with our first case, I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have three arguments on the docket this afternoon, 1:30, 2:30, and 3:30. Anybody who's here now is more than welcome to stick around after this case if you want to watch any of the other ones, of course. I understand that the parties have checked in, the lawyers have checked in. Before we start, I'll introduce our panel that we have today. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I will ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Glenn Daniel McCurley versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Myers will argue for the appellant, and Liz Rodriguez Sargent will argue for the state.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Myers, and I represent the appellant in this case, Glenn Samuel McCurley. The first three issues of this case, dealing with the lack of accreditation or license, present the court with a question that the court should easily answer, and that is, do we follow what the legislature wrote in the law? Or do we decide what the law should be or could have been? And in this particular case, those three issues start out with the accreditation of Othram. And I know the court has read the briefs, so that I don't need to rehash all that. But the bottom line is Othram was not accredited by the Texas Commission on Forensic Sciences. Texas legislature wrote a statute that said evidence from a non-accredited lab is inadmissible. That should be the end of it. The state makes the argument that, well, what Othram does and what Othram did is something that just outpaced the legislature. That is something that the statute just doesn't cover. Well, we know that's not true, because if you look at the regulations which govern the operation of the Forensic Science Commission and the rules that it promulgated, it specifically included labs that do SNPs. And we know from the record in this case that the use of SNPs was critical to the examination that Othram did.
Let me interject real quick, Counselor.
Please.
I understand what you're saying about it being used as evidence, but, I mean, evidence can be used for different types of purposes. You have evidence that can be used in court, and obviously law enforcement relies on evidence frequently just in furthering their investigation. You know, what we have here is law enforcement using something as a piece to further their investigation. And I immediately, in reading and preparing for this, thought about DWI jurisprudence. We have portable breath tests. And portable breath tests, the result of those is not admissible in a court of law, but it is admissible for an officer to testify, well, I did a portable breath test, and those results aided me in my reasonable suspicion. They aided me in believing that I needed to further my investigation. And because I furthered that investigation, I then ultimately got testing later that was certified, that was passed all those levels of muster so that it was admissible in a court of law. You know, cop couldn't come in and testify and say the PBT result was this, but they can't come in and say, it made me believe that it was necessary to further my investigation. What is different about this fact pattern here and the situation that took place with this case? I mean, you have, they used testing from a laboratory that lacked certifications, but they only relied on that to further their investigation, to ultimately procure evidence before they actually made an arrest. What do you think is different about that?
Well, what's different is the legislature is clear that when we analyze DNA, that Texas is different from every other state. In Texas, labs have to be accredited in order to do DNA analysis, including SNPs. And what's different is that we want our DNA evidence to be admissible. We want our DNA evidence to be competently done. And we want a reliable result to be introduced to the jury, which is what was intended in this case and what ultimately would have happened or did happen. But it's not like a portable breath test in the sense that this DNA was tested by Othram and using a technology that is specifically governed by the rule.
With a PBT, there's not laws that dictate how that testing is done. It's simply just a device that's used to further investigations.
I would agree with that, right?
But you have, but is the law on DNA testing and what's necessary, does it go to only admissibility, or does it go to just testing in general? You can't do DNA testing unless you do it under the way the code says.
You can, any lab can do all the DNA testing they want to do, and anybody can contract with them to do it. The problem comes in Article 3835 that says the results are inadmissible. The evidence is inadmissible.
Was the DNA results, did it ever actually ultimately, did he admit it? Did the trial court admit it? Is that correct? Is that...
This is a case, Your Honor, where the defendant pled guilty and preserved his right to appeal. So what the record consists of, my position is limited to those pretrial issues.
Right.
Do you agree with the state, excuse me, that even if what Othram did shouldn't have entered into this case at all, that we're looking at a harm analysis in the
end?
Well,
if we want to jump to the harm analysis, which is something I don't really think either side briefed because that's the job of the Court of Appeals, but I would refer the court to Retta versus State, 2008 Texas Appeals Lexus 4016 out of San Antonio, and Johnson versus State from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, 43 Southwest 3rd 1, Hoff versus State out of Amarillo, 516 Southwest 3rd 137, Kraft versus State, which is an old Court of Criminal Appeals case, it's 762 Southwest 2nd 612, and Johnson versus State, 72 Southwest 3rd at 346, and Hoff versus State at 516 3rd 137. Those cases deal with how do we look at harm when somebody has pled guilty and preserved their right to appeal. Well, first we have to decide, is it constitutional or is it non-constitutional? I would concede, obvious, that Article 3835 is a statute. It's not a constitutional concept. So we look under 44.2B, right, as to whether substantial rights were affected. These cases have been clear that the standard in that situation is whether a party had a right to that which the error denied. You don't look at whether he's guilty or not. That's not part of the analysis. You don't look at the weight of the evidence, because that's not part of the analysis. Texas courts have presumed that the denial of the motion to suppress influenced the defendant's decision to plead guilty, presumed it, and found the denial reversible error, so long as the evidence that should have been suppressed would in any measure inculpate the accused. That's Paulia versus State, 278 Southwest 3rd at 861. So I appreciate the harm question because, to me, that's where you end up on all three issues, the first three issues. It's clear Othram was not accredited. It's clear they didn't go through the process to seek an exemption from being required to be accredited. It's clear that 4 out of 5 of their lab employees were not licensed. And it's clear with the Siri lab that the one lab worker who did a test, who did a forensic analysis on this DNA that was the single source profile from Siri lab, was not licensed.
So you disagree with Judge Beach's conclusion about that particular Siri employee?
Oh, definitely. That employee was doing a quantification. The quantification step in DNA analysis is critical. And Ms. Pagankoff, the lab supervisor, admitted that, yes, it's a test. And under the code, you're required to be licensed if you're going to do a test. So, yes, I do disagree with those findings. I don't want to exhaust that particular issue, but I think that the other issues are very important. One dealing with whether a confession is induced in a capital murder case. When you tell the suspect, we're not going to seek the death penalty, just talk to us.
Well, there was
and you promise it.
But this was not a confession situation where it was like, I promise you won't get the death penalty. Okay, I'll talk. I mean, there was a big chunk of time with a lot of other discussion before he finally confessed, correct?
There was, but what preceded the confession was the use of the word promise. State wants to make a distinction. Well, he was talking about getting the electric chair or getting hung. That's not a distinction.
But he didn't believe the detectives when they told him that, did he? He said, they're not going to do that to you. Detective Bennett, no. Yeah, that's what you all say now.
Still wasn't an inducement.
It was an inducement if he didn't rely on it?
I think he did rely. How do we know he did not rely on it? How do we know?
Should there be something in the record indicating he did rely on it?
I don't think that the court, the measure of the elements for an unlawful inducement require proof of reliance, do they? Made by someone with authority, calculated to lead to a false statement. Made by a police officer in a capital murder case in a suspect interview. Do we really want to set that precedent?
He says, the suspect, and I'm not saying he said this, but the suspect says, I don't believe you. Can still call that an inducement?
I don't know that he said, I don't believe you.
I'm not saying he did.
Okay.
He said, that's what y'all say now.
Yes.
Which suggests some skepticism about what.
But then you made me a promise, right? You're not going to kill me. You have to take it out of the context of this case and think about the law you're making. Do we really want to tell officers in that interview room, when you got a capital murder suspect that you're interviewing, I promise you, you won't get the death penalty. Just talk to us. That's wrong. The other issue having to do with, which I think is the more fascinating issue for the court to ride on, is do you have a privacy right in your DNA profile from abandoned trash? You do. You should. The state's position is you don't because it's trash. Well, it's not the same. I'm going to take the yellow light and stop so I can have some time.
Okay. Thank you.
Excuse me. May it please the court, Frederica Sargent for the Tarrant County Criminal District Attorney's Office. As we've already discussed here a little bit today, forensic grade genome sequencing, FGGS, is an investigative tool, and that is all that it is. It is changing the way cases, particularly cold cases, are being investigated, and its usefulness as an investigative tool cannot be overstated. But its newness is precisely why the exclusionary rule found in Article 3835 should not apply, and why the trial court's denial of appellant's motion to suppress should be upheld. The trial court, yes, incorrectly relied on the exemption provision, which is exclusively for the commission. Only the commission can grant the exemption based on unavailability or inappropriateness. However, it is the state's position that unavailability lies outside of that exemption provision. It also lies in the fact that accreditation is based on, is tied to 3801, where the rules start, and then you go to the rules that have been promulgated by the commission. Appellant points to the fact that DNA SNP is listed as one of those groups that needs to be accredited. The DNA SNP is an oversimplification. It's simply not, it's too small for what Othram does. The testimony made very clear that their work is much bigger than that and involves huge pieces of the human genome, tens to thousands to hundreds of thousands of pieces of the genome. There is currently no lab in the country that is accredited to do this work of any kind, and we would assume that they all work on the same type of DNA SNP, that they all use that, because that's what they have to use to make their kits compatible with the ancestry websites that they ultimately upload the information to. There was testimony that the FBI, the Texas Rangers, have both used labs like Othram to do exactly this kind of work, because there is no government agency, government lab that is accredited to do this work. It's just...
Have there been any appellate decisions where a defendant has challenged the fact that these outsourced labs were not accredited?
There is a single case in the entire country that I could find. I don't know if I have that site with me. It's State versus Bortry. It's out of Ohio. And all they discuss is the fact that this forensic genetic genealogy is an investigative tool.
It's about Bortry. Do you remember the name Bortry?
Bortry, B-O-R-E-T-R-E-E. It is the only case that I could find, like I said, in the entire country that has even mentioned this. It's not to say, obviously, we know from the media that it's been gaining popularity and being used a lot. It's just that courts have not had a chance to write on it or examine it at the appellate level.
Is there any Texas case suggesting that simply because something is cutting edge or that it's not subject to the licensure requirement?
Not that I could find, no. There's very little law specifically tied to the commission and its work.
Would you say that this is hindsight? But,
sure.
But a lab like Othram, it could go to the commission and say, hey, look, we're cutting edge. Would you give us a waiver?
This would be, I presume, the exemption.
Exemption.
Yeah, the exemption idea. Hindsight, they probably could. We have nothing in the record. They were never asked directly if they sought an exemption, so we're going to presume that they did not. However, there are several good reasons why an exemption would not be appropriate. First of all, Othram was very clear that they want an accreditation. They want to be accredited. They are actually working with the commission, with the UNT Center for Human Remains, Identification of Human Remains, and other agencies to develop standards for accreditation so this science can be accredited both in Texas and at the national level. So, as I said, the record bears out that they probably did not want an exemption. The other thing about an exemption is that if you look at the list in section 651.7, there are a lot of standalone tests, and they are what one might consider the soft sciences. It's not anything like DNA testing, which, as we know, is the whole basis for the creation of the commission in the first place. It was the problems that we were having with DNA testing way back in the early 2000s. So, and even though there is also a provision that says if you get on the list, you can be removed later if the commission determines that the reason for your exemption is no longer good, that just feels like more bureaucracy. And so, again, Othram was looking to get accredited, and perhaps an exemption would stand in the way of that. We just don't know how all this works behind the scenes with the commission.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
If law enforcement, in this case, had stopped after the DNA testing and just gone immediately and arrested this individual, do you think there would have been a problem at that point?
Which DNA testing?
Well, it would be the Othram testing.
The Othram testing? Yes, because this is not what Othram does, what labs like it do, it is not meant to support an arrest, much less a conviction. In this case, the testing, when it was completed and Othram called Detective Bennett, he was told there's a family. It's Anderson, Adams, McCurley. That's the sort of the group of family. We've got a name. And when they told Bennett the name, Detective Bennett the name, he was like, oh my gosh, that name was in the file in 1974. Was it Glenn Samuel? And they said, no, it was Samuel Glenn, but he died about a year ago. Was there a junior? Was the next question. Yes, there is. This is Glenn Samuel, but there are also two brothers. So now the detectives have to do their regular boots on the ground investigation. They have to collect DNA, if they can, from Mr. McCurley, from the appellant. They still have to put him in the parking lot. They have to get his, you know, all the DNA stuff, all the regular things that they do outside of this. They still have to do that so that they have enough evidence to support a conviction.
Do you think there's a difference in the legal analysis that a court might do if an officer testified that Othram's DNA testing indicated X, Y, and Z, as opposed to an officer testifying, Othram did some testing, what they told me made us think that we needed to further our investigation. Do you see a difference in that?
I think either way, they're furthering their investigation. They're going out and they're doing more work. They're doing their regular work. All this is doing, all of the work that Othram and labs like it, when they do this FGGS, is helping law enforcement get leads, perhaps where there were no leads at all or where there were too many leads. It can help them narrow the suspect pool.
But Offram's conclusions were going to come before the jury in this case.
Yes. And I think we tie that, although not in the briefing, but we tie that to 3914 and what it requires, because all of this work has to be turned over to defense counsel anyway, as part of that under 3914.
Well, and as I recall, didn't one of the interviewing officers say, I guess it was in the pretrial, mm-hmm. that she would not have had probable cause just based on, was it just based on the Othram or?
They, on the, to get the DNA on the, to get a warrant for the trash run?
Right. They couldn't have gotten a warrant for the trash run because they didn't have, just what they got from Othram was not.
Right. All they had at that point was the Othram, whatever Othram had told them. And then they had the evidence, if you will, from 1974, which was the magazine that had been found in the parking lot, that, you know, and they had the interview that McCurley had given where he told officers in 1974 and repeated the story again multiple times in this current investigation that his gun had been stolen, but he had nevertheless bought a new magazine, which officers at the time and now thought was very strange. But they didn't have the gun itself. He had apparently passed a polygraph, and so without anything else, he was cleared as a suspect. They couldn't put him in the parking lot or, you know, even in the area, I don't think, but that's neither here nor there. This is what they had. They had the Othram evidence, and they had the magazine, and his story about buying a new magazine for, you know, to replace it in a gun that was stolen. That's not going to add up to probable cause.
Well, what about counsel's suggestion that issue four is an interesting one, whether we have, you know, even if we've abandoned our trash because lots of high-level technological testing has to be done to mm-hmm. locate DNA, does that take it out of the realm of something that's, you know, immediately apparent when you're going through somebody's trash? And raise privacy concerns.
I definitely agree. It's a fascinating topic. In preparation for this brief, I read a number of law review articles that cover this topic pretty extensively. But the far-reaching concerns of this are not at issue here. And by that, I mean the primary concerns seem to be that law enforcement will be able to just randomly test your trash, get a DNA sample, and then they're going to know your whole genetic makeup. And by that I mean the genetic makeup that includes your disease history, what you might be susceptible to, what you've had, maybe if you have some mental issues, whatever you can show from DNA is now available to law enforcement. And that is just simply not the case. Law enforcement at this point, and there are strict standards in place everywhere, they use it only for identification purposes. They don't use it for anything else. And to the extent any of that shows up, but even as Dr. Fon, like the STR DNA that they use in CODIS absolutely does not show any of these things. So that those concerns just aren't there.
Well, is that the only focus of a privacy argument that maybe people could be unwittingly giving up disease related information? Mm-hmm. What about just the idea that taking somebody's trash and getting any sort of DNA information that leads to identification when you wouldn't otherwise be able to just see it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. That is definitely the harder question. So far, courts have steadfastly said that collecting DNA off discarded items is fine. It remains fine under California versus Greenwood and its progeny. The Supreme Court's last foray into this area, Maryland versus King, involved, it was slightly different circumstances. You had DNA being taken after a man was arrested for a serious assault, so it was taken as part of the regular booking process. But at the towards the end of the court's opinion, they get into some of these privacy concerns and again went into, this is only for identification, we're not using it for anything else. Trash runs, you know, again, it's abandoned property. So far no court has said, has waded into that. And even the Supreme Court said, we're gonna leave these more difficult questions of privacy and the Fourth Amendment and taking DNA for another case, for a case that presents facts that would allow us to actually write a significant holding.
And would you say a case like this would be one of those cases? Because he wasn't in custody, it was, I won't say it was a fishing expedition, because they certain, the law enforcement mm-hmm. certainly had information that was pointing to Mr. McCurley. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't in custody, and it wasn't part of the normal.
No, but he was a suspect at that point. So I would say no, this is not that case, because he was an identified suspect. He was a suspect in 1974. He was a suspect again in 2019 when Detectives Wagner and Bennett reopened the case. He was immediately, you know, at the top of their list.
So would you say that is a distinguishing fact, as opposed to, for example, law enforcement going around and collecting trash from everybody's home in a six-block area of where the victim was found and just...
Absolutely. Absolutely. They went, they confirmed that he lived at his home, you know, at this home where they had an address for him, before they did anything. They didn't just do some generalized sweep of the entire neighborhood.
I keep thinking about, and it may even be the wrong doctrine, to be honest. I don't know everything, but attenuation of the taint. And I don't think you pointed this out in your brief, but he ultimately gave voluntarily.
Yes, he did.
A sample of his DNA.
Yes, he did.
That matched.
Yes.
DNA that was found on her bra.
Yes.
So couldn't you argue that it doesn't matter? I mean, what DNA was found in the trash,
mm-hmm.
it really doesn't matter, because he ultimately just gave DNA and had law enforcement just, why did they search the trash? Because they never knew that he might actually give it to them.
Sure.
So once he gave it to them freely and voluntarily, then the, you know, search and seizure goes out the window.
He gave Absolutely.
It. And so couldn't you say that the taint is attenuated, that... That it's not an issue anymore because ultimately they found his DNA?
I could absolutely argue that. You could absolutely say that whatever, you know, evil doing came from the trash run and the surreptitious taking of his DNA, yes, was obviated by the fact that he gave a consensual swab, buccal swab, with, you know, when the officers went to his house, when Detectives Wagner and Bennett went to his house to talk to him.
And had they done that first, they clearly wouldn't have searched his trash.
Clearly,
They did that just in case he wouldn't give them freely and voluntarily a sample of DNA.
I'm assuming, I don't know, you know, all the ins and outs, but yeah, it's possible.
Appellant's counsel places a lot of emphasis on the cell tower and the thermal imaging case. How do you distinguish those?
I distinguish those by saying, if you look at both Carpenter and Holder, there is a heavy discussion of just exactly of a couple things. First of all, how much information you get from both a cell phone and the cell site location information. It's described as an intimate window into familial, political, professional, religious, and sexual associations. It's described as remarkably cheap, easy, and efficient. And on top of everything else, it is near perfect surveillance, even without knowledge that your person is a suspect. So 5 years from now, any one of us could be a suspect in a crime, and the police can go back in time for 5 years, which is the average time that the cell phone companies hold on to this information, and they can track our movements. They'll know who we called, they'll know where we went, where we were, on what day, at what time. The Supreme Court described it as deeply revealing in nature, its depth, its breadth, the comprehensive reach.
Isn't a profile pretty deeply revealing in nature?
It is. I would agree that it is. But on the other hand, it is not as easy to get, one. This just requires, you know, the cell phone companies, they have it already. It requires a piece of paper. And they'll give it to you. The DNA information, one, is, again, I say, not used for these purposes. It is only for identification. Whatever horrors, you know, house of horrors come out of this for diseases and whatnot, okay. It's just not there.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time is up.
Yes, I see that.
That's my fault.
Okay, that's all right. Would you add another minute to Mr. Meyer's time, please, if he needs it? Thank you.
I'm going to start with a question for you because it goes to right what the state was just talking about, and that is, I guess one of the issues is, hasn't there been occasions where individuals have been identified through this DNA and then found later that it would be an absolute impossibility for that person to have been the person to commit the crime, i.e., they didn't even live at the time that the crime was committed, things like that. That would be one of the concerns. Would you say so from your position on the issue of what we were talking about?
I'm sorry. I don't understand the question. You're saying that how does that relate to this case, I guess?
Well, I mean, we're talking about pretty much the reasonable expectation of privacy to that type of material, right. And of course one of the concerns about whether or not you would have that expectation of privacy would be whether or not something could ultimately happen that just would be person could get identified as somebody who violated the law who didn't violate the law at all. That's one of the concerns.
Well, I think if you read Justice Scalia's dissent in Maryland, joined by Justice Thomas, he says, it's going to happen, folks. You're going to have a national DNA database. So if that answers or at least touches on your question, this issue about enhanced technology, Holder had nothing to do with enhanced technology. I think the court is asking a question that deals with Riley and the thermal imaging. Cell tower records are a completely different animal. We're talking about you got a cell phone in your lawful custody, Mr. Officer. Well, I'm just going to search it. Well, no, you're not, because you got to have a warrant to do that. And that's the similarity here, is that I don't disagree that they could have probably gotten a warrant to develop a DNA profile from the examined trash. The question is, should they? Does the government have a responsibility to protect our privacy and not invade our privacy by getting our full DNA profile from abandoned trash? That's the issue. It's not readily apparent. It's not in plain view. A DNA profile doesn't even exist until it's developed by scientific enhanced technology means. Is it voluntary? When you walked in that bench today and sat down, did you voluntarily leave your DNA? All of our DNA is everywhere. The abandonment doctrine depends on a voluntary relinquishment. We cannot not relinquish our DNA and still live in the world unless we wear a Tyvek suit and don't go out of our houses. I, for one, want the government to have to get a warrant to get my DNA profile. That's just the way that is.
Is there any similarities between And I mean, there's been cases on point, you know, leaving fingerprints behind, leaving other types of identifying information behind, abandoning that voluntarily. You know, I would assume there's plenty of law out there that says that if a lady has lipstick, for example, on a cup, well, that would be DNA. But let's say a fingerprint, and then law enforcement later tests that fingerprint.
The distinction there is identification purposes versus non-identification purposes. The distinction is, what are we guarding against? If we're going to say, Mr. Officer, you can only obtain a DNA profile from abandoned trash if you're just going to use it for identification purposes, announce that rule.
Yeah.
But that's not the law. That's not the rule. There's no limits to what they can do with that. I was not smart enough to do civil, but going back to the criminal side of this inducement, the elements of inducement, which you asked about, was that there's some benefit to the defendant. It was a positive expression, and it was made or sanctioned by a person in authority and for as such characters would be likely to influence the defendant to speak untruthfully. There's no detrimental reliance, I guess, is my point, as far as the criminal law goes on the inducement.
What was the last element?
Of such a character as would be likely to influence the defendant to speak untruthfully. So you have to look at that, I think, in the context of not just this case, but any case. Like I was saying, any capital murder case. The issue about Othram, you know, Othram got a sample of DNA. Othram, on the front end of what they do, does everything an accredited lab is required to do, from chain of custody to analysis. It's only at that back end. And the legislature, we want to follow what the law is, not what we think it should be in a bad case. The legislature said, yeah, if you think you're doing something that accreditation doesn't apply to, you come to us. You ask us. You don't self-exempt yourself from the law. And again, this case has to be looked at from the standpoint of, it's not a fully developed record. It was a plea. Preserving the right to appeal, issues raised by pretrial motion.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time's up.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Counsel. The argument has been very helpful. We appreciate the time and answering our questions. Your case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until our 2:30 argument.